a few bad puns. So far, Georgie had played Ophelia in a wetted slip, sighing and swooning across the battlements of Elsinore, Rosalind in breeches strutting through the forest of Arden, and a surprisingly musical Lady Macbeth, rending her bodice in strategic ways as she called upon the spirits to unsex her here. That had evoked a great deal of very predictable commentary from the stalls.
"Just be grateful it wasn't Macbeth," said Georgie grimly. "You haven't seen anything until you've seen Birnam Wood showing its shimmy all the way to Dunsinane."
The skin around Mr. Vandyval's eyes crinkled.
"Isn't it bad luck to say the name of the Scottish play?"
"Did you think anything could make the Ali Baba much worse?"
"I didn't mean that the show wasn't good. It was quite
awful.
I was going to say unique."
They walked in silence for a moment before Mr. Vandyval ventured,
"If you'll forgive my asking, why 11 1/9 nights?
"The Grand Pajandrum, that's Mr. Dunstan, the proprietor, thought it would be more likely to bring in the punters than Twelfth Night. Shades of Scheherazade and all that."
Mr. Vandyval looked down at her with new interest.
"You've read The 1001 Nights?
"Bits of it."
Georgie wasn't about to admit to reading. Men expected their chorus girls to conform to a pattern. It didn't do to disrupt their thinking. Keep her head down and keep moving. That's what she had learned.
"Everyone was talking about it. You'll have noticed the name of the theatre?"
"The name of the... oh."
Mr. Vandyval grinned sheepishly.
"The Ali Baba, of course."
"Instead of 40 thieves, you only get your pocket picked by one, the ticket taker.
Sorry, house joke." "Mind the puddle."
Mr. Vandyval took her arm, guiding her away from a damp patch that was undoubtedly more than rainwater. His touch was gentle, respectful. He made her feel almost like the lady she might once have been. An illusion, like the stage on which they played. With murmured thanks, Georgie tucked her arm close to her side, wearing her coat like armor. Ahead of them, Kitty's arm was entwined with Sir Hugo's, his lips close to her ear as they made their progress down the ill-lit street. He was saying something about Deauville and the races and the beautiful people who filled the stands, his aristocratic drawl weaving webs of fancy around Kitty, 1001 tales of wonder. Although Georgie doubted Sir Hugo would keep her for the whole of one night, much less 1,000. That Kitty was caught, Georgie had no doubt. She could see it shining in her eyes, glassy with gin and ambition.
"Oh, Kitty," thought Georgie.
Kitty hadn't got over the dream that her prince would come, would see her on stage and sweep her away to a life of riches and leisure, stretched out on a chaise lounge with minions bustling about, bringing her bonbons. All it took was for one gaiety girl to marry a marquis, and the entire chorus went broody. But the Ali Baba wasn't the gaiety, and Sir Hugo Med Menem was no prince.
"What was that?"
Mr. Vandyval was speaking, but she hadn't marked him. Georgie gave her head a little shake. If Sir Hugo was suspect, then his friend must be as well, no matter how sympathetic he might seem.
"Sorry, I was away with the fairies."
"That's a different play, isn't it?"
The words were bantering, but the tone was gentle. Mr. Vandyval matched his stride to hers, keeping careful pace.
"It's no matter. I'd only asked if you'd been at the Ali Baba long."
"Just over a year."
It had been a marked step up from her previous engagement, where she had been a member of a ragtag excuse for a chorus.
"It's hardly Drury Lane, but..."
"At least they don't sell us with the tickets." That was what she had been about to say, but she caught herself in time. Just because Mr. Vandyval's voice was kind, his demeanor respectful, didn't mean it was safe to show a weakness. She'd met soft-spoken villains before, and not all on the stage.
"It's a pleasant enough place if you don't mind the assault on the English language," said Georgie flippantly. "Is this your first trip to London?"
"It's my first time abroad."
If Mr. Vandyval thought the change of subject odd, he didn't comment on it.
You must think me very provincial.
No more provincial than any Londoner. We are none of us worldly here.
In the quiet side street, her voice sounded too brassy, too strident, a caricature of what she pretended to be.
Where are you from when you're at home?
New York. We've been there since old Peter Stuyvesant, over 200 years.
Mr. Vandyval gestured at the curve of the street, the soot-grimed facades of houses that looked as though they had been there from time immemorial.
That mustn't sound like much to you.
Georgie thought of the house where she had spent her childhood, the ruins of an old abbey built onto and around, medieval cloisters turned into garden follies, a 16th-century house built onto the ruins of a 12th-century church, an 18th-century manor grafted onto that. The family who owned it liked to claim they could trace their roots even deeper than that, back, back, back before William the Conqueror.
"There are times," she said dryly, "when a week feels like a century."
Especially that first year in London, living from meal to meal, scrabbling to find the coin to pay her landlady. She could look back on it now, the fear, the desperation, as though it were a story told about someone else. The Ali Baba was hardly Illyria, but it would serve, so long as it lasted. The image of those empty seats nagged at her. Georgie pushed the worrying thought aside.
"It's all in the eye of the beholder, isn't it?"
"Truth or beauty?"
Mr. Vandyval asked wryly, and Georgie had that hint again of something beneath that mild surface, something more complex than it appeared. Truth is beauty, beauty truth. She had believed that once, with the same confidence with which she had believed that rank meant security and lineage gentility. But a long row of family portraits hadn't protected Annabel.
"Truth and beauty are meant to be one and the same, aren't they?"
she said belligerently.
"That's what the poets say."
Even if it was a lie, even if a beautiful face, a warm voice, could be nothing more than a lure, the presage to pain.
"But are they?"
Mr. Vandyval's question was without mockery. Georgie couldn't tell if he was in earnest or merely playing at it. Truths weren't what she offered.
"You're asking the wrong person. I work in the theatre. Everything is an illusion."
"You say that very honestly."
There was something disconcerting about Mr. Vandyval's concentrated attention.
"Is it less a lie for being an open one?"
she asked. The last thing she could be accused of was being honest. He'd been gammoned, poor man. The cost of a dinner and all he would get at the end was words for his trouble. Twice used words at that. It was his friend who would go home to a warm bed at the end of the night, at least if the way Kitty was leaning on his arm was any indication, while Vandyval would be left to sport the blunt. Vandyval shook his fair head.
"You're too quick for me, Miss Evans. You spin webs with your words."
Georgie shrugged.
"There's nothing in them to hold. I only work with borrowed words."
"Aren't all words had at second hand?"
Mr. Vandyval tilted his head back to look at the smoke-gray sky, and Georgie became aware, for the first time, of the difference in their heights, and of how close he had been leaning, how low he had bent to listen to her.
"When you think about it, everything has been said before, in one way or another. It's only our experience of it that makes it new."
He wasn't going to be having any new experiences tonight, not with her. With deliberate derision, Georgie said,
"I thought you didn't weep for Hecuba. Do you always argue both sides, Mr. Vandyval?"
Mr. Vandyval's face lit with an unexpected smile.
"I'm an attorney. I'm paid to argue both sides."
"An attorney?"
Georgie couldn't have been more shocked than if he had told her he was the Prince of Wales or the Dustman. Attorneys were elderly men with whiskers down to their chins. They were respectable and professional, and had no truck with rakes such as Sir Hugo. Or, more to the point, rakes such as Sir Hugo had no truck with them.
Mr. Vandyval smiled at her astonishment.
Like you, Miss Evans, I'm paid for my words, except in prose rather than verse, and rather more heretofores and wheretofores.
Aren't attorneys meant to be elderly and respectable?
They came to a stop before the pale stone facade of the Criterion, marble nymphs simpering down from their niches. Mr. Vandyval spread his hands wide.
Mightn't attorneys be young ones, too?
And respectable?
She hadn't meant it to sound like flirting. It just came out that way.
What makes you think a lawyer is more proof against the frailties of the flesh than any other man?
Mr. Vandyval's eyes met hers, as bright as ice over water.
Knowledge of the law is a trade, not a guarantee of virtue.
Georgie's skin heated despite the February chill. Excitement and trepidation mingled together.
If you will.
Sir Hugo jostled rudely between them. Georgie jerked quickly aside, her heel catching on the hem of her skirt. Mr. Vandyval lurched forward to steady her, but Sir Hugo was there before him, catching her around the waist in a grip that belied his languid manner. Sir Hugo gave her a squeeze before releasing her. The intimacy of his hand on her hip made the bile rise in Georgie's throat.
I acknowledge the obvious fascination of Miss Evans's conversation, but there are other hungers that demand to be satisfied.
I presume you mean supper? Said Mr. Vandyval, a warning in his voice.
What else? Would you prefer to continue to debate the number of angels dancing on pins, or shall we proceed to our table? Unless, of course,
Sir Hugo added silkily, smiling at Georgie in a way that made her skin crawl and her throat tight.
You would rather forego the formality of a meal.
Georgie found she was shaking, although whether with anger or fear she couldn't have said.
The price of this meal is too dear for me. I'm for home, alone.
There's no need for that. Mr. Vandyval stepped between her and Sir Hugo, shielding her with his body, his eyes on Sir Hugo's face.
You are making the lady uncomfortable, Hugo.
And we mustn't do that.
Sir Hugo turned to the waiting maitre d'.
My good man, we require a table for these ladies.
We have a table for you on the first floor, sir, said the maitre d'.
One couldn't turn away Sir Hugo Medmenham, even when he appeared with two rouged drabs in tow, thought Georgie. She repressed the hysterical bubble that rose in her throat. Was that what they were? Was that what they would be if the Ali Baba closed its doors? A coin passed from Sir Hugo's palm to the gatekeepers.
Then take us there, before we grow much older.
To Mr. Vandyval he said in dulcet tones,
We must all gather our rosebuds while we may, mustn't we, Bay? They wilt so rapidly once plucked.
A voice whispered in Georgie's ear. Go on, tell them if you like. Who do you think will believe you? A voice from another day, another time, but there was something in Sir Hugo's stance, something in the glitter of the silver head of his cane, that made Georgie snatch her coat back from the hovering waiter's grasp.
I've lost my appetite.
She reached for Kitty.
Come on, Kitty, it's late.
Not that late.
Kitty made an impatient face at Georgie, rolling her eyes in the direction of the staircase.
It'd be rude to leave now.
Yes, terribly rude, drawled Sir Hugo. Who knows what pleasures the night might prove?
Supper, said Mr. Vandyval in a clipped voice. Sir Hugo inspected the head of his cane, the silver shimmering dizzyingly in the lamplight.
Do you have an objection to dessert?
Mr. Vandyval gave up pretending. Or maybe it was all pretense, thought Georgie, shrugging rapidly into her coat. The other diners were beginning to stop and stare, but she didn't care.
Not of the sort you imply.
How narrow you are in your tastes,
said Sir Hugo. But it was enough to drive the color to Mr. Vandyval's cheeks.
And what of your fiancé, Hugo?
Mr. Vandyval's voice carried, causing stares from a party coming up the stairs from the theater below.
Would she approve? There was a charged silence, broken only by the muted sounds of conversation and cutlery from the surrounding rooms. Sir Hugo broke his gaze first, turning to Kitty with exaggerated solicitude.
My dear, this company wearies me. Shall we leave them to their supper and their virtue?
Kitty nodded her head and put her hand in the crook of Sir Hugo's arm.
There's champagne at the Alhambra.
We've a matinee tomorrow, Kitty, Georgie warned.
We can sing those songs in our sleep.
Kitty's smile was bright, but there was desperation in the way her fingers curled into the fine cloth of Sir Hugo's coat.
Don't fuss, Georgie.
Don't fuss. That was what Annabel used to say, too, so sure of herself, so sure that nothing could touch her. Hugo, Mr. Van Dyvel stepped forward to intercept them. Sir Hugo merely ushered Kitty past him.
Good night, Miss Evans. Bay, I recommend you try the oysters.
Arm in arm, not looking back, Sir Hugo and Kitty strolled down the stairs and into the fog. In the mist they shimmered like ghosts before disappearing around the curve of the street. And Georgie stood there, watching them go, feeling her chest rise and fall beneath her bodice, her hands damp in her gloves. Georgie wanted to run after her friend and grab her back, but Kitty wouldn't thank her for it. She had to remember that.
"Sir," said the maitre d',
"Sir, will you be wanting a table?"
"No,"
said Georgie too loudly. She looked fiercely at Mr. Van Dyvel, daring him to challenge her. With deliberate crudity, she said,
"You'd best go fishing for your oysters elsewhere."
Mr. Van Dyvel blinked several times. He wrenched his eyes away from the misty street and back to Georgie.
"I'll see you home."
Hastily, he handed the long-suffering maitre d' a fistful of coins.
"For your troubles."
Georgie was already halfway down the stairs.
"I'll see myself."
Mr. Van Dyvel hurried to catch up with her, his greatcoat billowing around him.
"Let me put you in a hackney, at least."
Georgie thrust her hands deep in her pockets and kept walking, setting her face against the wind.
"There's no need."
"There's every need."
Cutting around her, Mr. Van Dyvel signaled to the rank of cabs waiting down the street from the Criterion, before turning back to Georgie, two deep lines furrowing the skin between his eyes.
"He doesn't mean ill."
Georgie looked at him incredulously. Did he really believe that? Perhaps. A man might gamble and whore and still be accounted a good fellow, provided he held his liquor and paid the most pressing of his debts.
"Not to you, maybe."
The cab pulled up in front of them. Mr. Van Dyvel put a hand to the door, but didn't open it. He looked down at Georgie, saying slowly,
"I don't understand."
Georgie shook her head, impatient with herself and with him.
"A man might keep his word to his friends, but what's a woman to him?"
Mr.
Van Dyvel blinked, his Adam's apple moving up and down in his throat.
"Would you like me to go after them?"
Georgie started to laugh, but Mr. Van Dyvel's face was serious.
"Spare your sword, Sir Galahad. They wouldn't thank you for it, either of them." "Do you want a ride or not?" called the cabbie.
More coins jingling in Mr. Van Dyvel's hand. Rich American, Kitty had said. Either he was or he was making a good show of it. Mr. Van Dyvel opened the door, stepping back to allow Georgie to enter.
"Take this lady..."
Georgie's lips pressed into a thin line. She was hardly going to tell him her address. Not even if he was what he appeared, an innocent abroad. Mr. Van Dyvel shut the door and took a step back.
"Take this lady wherever she instructs you."
Georgie felt the breath that she had been holding release. She felt both relieved and yet not disappointed. Ashamed? If this Mr. Van Dyvel was genuinely kind, then she had used him ill. He may have been friends with Sir Hugo, but there was something terribly forlorn about him, alone on the street corner outside the Criterion.
"Good night, Mr. Van Dyvel," said Georgie grudgingly.
"Good night, Miss Evans."
He tipped his hat to her, and then, the words almost lost beneath the crack of the coachman's whip, something that sounded like,
"I'm sorry."
Georgie tightened her hand around the leather strap as the cab jolted forward. She willed herself not to look back. What was the point? It was hardly likely that her path and Mr. Van Dyvel's would cross again. But she looked back all the same, to see him standing there still, dwindling away to a creature of mist and fog, as the dray horse's hoofbeats echoed hollowly in Georgie's ears. Chapter 3 New York, 1899, January.
Mother?
Servants could enter without knocking, but not Janie. She rapped again at the oak door, half hoping there would be no answer. Another knock, more tentative now. Janie heard noises on the other side of the door, a sound like a dog panting, heavy, wet breathing, like sobs. Janie paused, one hand pressed flat against the door, unsure whether to enter or leave. It seemed the sort of thing a daughter should do, comfort her mother in time of grief. But her mother wouldn't thank her for being caught out in a weakness. If that was what it was, and not the sound of the wind howling in the chimney, or, as Janie's mother would undoubtedly say, Janie's own overactive imagination, turning silence into sobs and sorrow. Janie was about to slip away when the summons came. Her mother's voice was muffled by the wood, but no less autocratic for all that.
"What are you waiting for? Come in!"
Janie cracked the door open.
"Anne said you wanted me?"
Her mother's eyes were suspiciously red, but if she had been crying, she gave no other sign.
"Sit and read to me."
No protestations of affection, no words of consolation. But for the black beads on Mother's dress and the thin lines on either side of her mouth, it might have been any other night. Janie had always suspected that her mother's demand that Janie read to her before supper was a form of penance for both of them. For Janie, for her failure to be married, and for her mother, for having a daughter so alien to her in taste and temperament.
"Well, don't just stand there!"
Murmuring an apology, Janie sat in her usual place, on a low stool on the far side of her mother's dressing table. A book sat ready for her, a heavy volume in red Morocco covers with a leather bookmark inserted into it. Janie opened it and began reading at random, the words tripping off her lips without touching her mind. A small enough rebellion to let her mind wander while reading her mother's chosen words, but it made her feel as though she were keeping some small part of herself, something that hadn't been pounded into drabness. Her father had been a collector of rare books. Not Americana, which might have been respectable in its familiarity, but French poetry and plays. He had been a quiet man in his everyday life, his hair brown to his wife's gold, a bit stooped in his stance, his Van Dyvel blue eyes blurred behind spectacles. And yet in the privacy of his own study, he became something else entirely. An actor on his private stage. Janie's earliest memories were of sitting beside her father in his study while the sonorous phrases rolled off his tongue. Her father had died when she was 11 years old, his absence scarcely detectable in the house in which his wife ruled as queen, except to Janie. Her mother found her one night, curled in her nightdress in her father's chair, reading to herself from the fairy tales of Madame le Prince de Beaumont. Within a month his books had been boxed, the room in which her father had stored his treasures dismantled. Janie had stolen what she could, squirreling a handful of precious books away in caches in the nursery. Bay had known, but he hadn't said anything.
By some alchemy, he had persuaded Anne to hold her tongue as well. Anne had shrugged and said she didn't see what the bother was about a bunch of old books. Janey might have told her if she could have found the words, but as always with her brother and cousin, her tongue tied in knots, and all she could do was hug the book to her chest and duck her head. When she thought of Bay, that was what she remembered, his hand silently replacing the book that had fallen from beneath her pillow. They might not have been close, but he had always been kind, not out of any desire for gratitude or to extract favors in return, but because that was part of who he was. It came as naturally to him as breathing. They had never confided in one another, but Bay had shielded her in a dozen ways, drawing their mother's attention away from Janey at the breakfast table, giving her a respite from the endless admonitions to sit up straighter, chew more quietly, stepping in front of her in the water at Bailey's Beach to shield her from curious eyes that day her bathing costume had torn. The Bay she had known wasn't capable of pushing his wife into a river or plunging a knife into his chest. What had happened in that house on the Hudson? Janey let the book fall into her lap. What happens next? It took her mother a moment to realize the reading had stopped. Mother's head turned a fraction, the slight tightening of her brows the only sign of her displeasure.
Nothing that need concern us.
She hadn't seen him, Janey reminded herself. Her mother hadn't seen Bay, spangled with snowflakes like silver thread, hadn't heard the horrible rattle and wheeze of his breath as he struggled to speak. And even if she had, her mother came of an older, sterner school that prized self-control over sentiment. Janey had always thought her mother would have made a brilliant Roman matron, all strong profile and impeccably draped white robes, half marble even in the flesh. No, that was unfair. It wasn't that her mother was made of stone, devoid of feeling. It was more that the deeper the emotion, the more firmly her mother strove to contain it. And Bay's loss must have cut very deep indeed. Bay had been her mother's darling, the hoped-for heir to the Van Dyvel name. Janey closed the book around her finger, feeling the weight of the pages digging into her flesh.
Will there be an inquest?
One assumes.
It was the clipped voice her mother used to dampen the pretensions of the wives of railroad barons and copper kings.
You appear to lack attention tonight, Janey. Is the reading matter not to your taste?
It was never to her taste, but that was beside the point. Janey edged forward on her stool.
Have you considered that we might perhaps hire someone to determine, that is, to discover?
The words tangled on her tongue, but she forced herself to keep going. An awful silence filled the room. Janey pressed her lips together, wishing she hadn't spoken.
Surely there must be some comfort in knowing the truth.
It struck her, belatedly, that James Burke had said much the same thing. And she had looked at him much the way her mother was looking at her now, with a mixture of distaste and pure scorn.
Do you wish to invite a stranger into the family's affairs?
Her mother's words were shards of ice, each knife sharp. It was too late to back down now, too late to wish the words unsaid. Janey stared down at the red Morocco binding of the book in her lap.
They're in our affairs, whether we invite them or not.
She could picture James Burke in the kitchen, his green eyes making mock of her scruples.
They don't care for the truth. All they care for is a good story. If someone had a grudge against Bay...
Her words trailed off as her mother fixed her with a hard brown stare.
I had never thought to see the day that a daughter of mine would pander to the common press.
It's not about the press. It's about justice.
Janey wasn't sure what she meant,
only that she couldn't let it go. Not now that she'd come so far.
What of the children? Surely Viola and Sebastian deserve better than to have their father branded a murderer and suicide.
The horrible words tainted the air between them. The scent of the hothouse flowers on her mother's dressing table saturated the room, overripe and sickly, cloying at Janie's nose. After a long, long moment, her mother turned back to her dressing table.
"You are overwrought."
Her mother reached for a strand of beads, held them against her high collar as though to study the effect, and then set them down again. Without looking at Janie, she said,
"You needn't bother to come down to dinner. A tray will be brought to your room."
Janie's hands tightened around the book in her lap as she felt the familiar patterns closing around her. She was 26 years old, but her mother could still send her to bed without supper.
I don't mind coming down.
She winced as she said it. Anne wouldn't have asked. Anne would have simply brazened her way downstairs in a Paris gown and dared Mrs. Van Dyvel to say anything about it. Sometimes Janie wondered if her life would have been different if she had been more like Anne, showier, stronger. There was a state of constant war between her mother and her cousin, but there was, she thought, a form of understanding as well. They respected each other, as warring nations do. But she wasn't like Anne. She was only bold and brave within the covers of her books.
"We mustn't risk your health."
Her mother slid a ring onto her finger, considered it, and replaced it with another. Her eyes met Janie's in the mirror. Her lips twisted into something like a grimace.
"You are the only child I have left to me."
Janie lowered her eyes to her lap, guilt and resentment twisting in her stomach. In the churchyard at Gray's Church were two small graves, two brothers Janie had never known, both carried away by the measles that had miraculously spared Bay. They never spoke of them, but Janie had always known that she was meant to be another boy, a replacement for Peter and Nicholas. Her failure to be so had been the first in the long series of disappointments that she had offered her mother. She wasn't really delicate, but it had become a family myth, invoked when convenient.
"You wear yourself to the bone with your charity work, Janie. Surely there is no need for such zeal at the expense of your health. How pale you look in that gown, Janie. It seems a trifle youthful, don't you think?"
Never an outright command, always an expression of concern. It was very hard to rail against measures taken ostensibly for one's own good. And perhaps they were. Whenever Janie felt herself pushed to the point of rebellion, she remembered those gravestones, and her protests died, stillborn, on her lips. And now Bay was gone, too.
"I am sorry."
It seemed such an inadequate thing to say, and somehow very odd to be apologizing for her own existence. Lifting her eyes to her mother's, she asked tentatively,
"Will you bring the children to town?"
"No."
Her mother rose from her seat, moving abruptly away.
"They're better where they are."
Alone on the Hudson with the snow swirling around the battlements.
"In the house where their parents..."
Her mother tugged at the bell to call her maid.
"It's their home, Janie, and they're only, what, 2 years old? They'll scarcely notice the difference."
3 and a half, nearly 4.
It didn't matter. Her mother knew exactly how old the twins were. To the day, Janie had no doubt. It was just more convenient for her to pretend otherwise.
"It was only a thought."
Maybe her mother was right. Maybe it was better to leave the children in their castle on the Hudson rather than confining them to a suite of rooms on the 5th floor, with lessons in the morning and formal outings on fine afternoons. She had been a child in this house. She knew what it was like. But she couldn't quite stop herself from adding,
"These are Bay's children. Van Dyvel's."
"Don't you think I know that?"
The words cracked through the room, loud enough to make Janie's ears ring. Janie saw the flush rise up her mother's neck, creeping up from her jet collar, past her dangling earrings, up to her brow.
"Lower your voice, Janie. Ladies don't shout."
But that had been a shout just now, unmistakably a shout. It was the first time she could recall her mother raising her voice. Ever. Someone cleared her throat from the doorway. Janie's mother drew herself up straighter, visibly pulling herself together, drawing her face back into its accustomed lines. As if nothing had happened, Janie's mother said,
"Gregson, Miss Janie is feeling unwell. You will prepare a tisane."
Turning to her daughter, she added,
"Your face is flushed, Janie. I suggest you lie down."
It was her mother who was flushed, not Janie. But Janie wasn't going to argue, not now. Janie rose from her seat, smoothing down her rumpled skirt.
"Yes, mother."
Her mother stood by the cloth-shrouded window, her profile to Janie. She seemed diminished, her spine less erect, the skin of her jaw less firm. Her color was still high, making her face look like a wax model of itself, out of drawing, not quite right. Janie hesitated. She should go to her, console her. But Gregson stood sentinel by the door, ready to repel any liberties.
"Good night, mother,"
Janie said instead, and received only a nod in return, as though the act of speaking was too much for her mother to bear. Feeling all her own inadequacy, Janie found her way to her own room, the room into which she had moved when she graduated from the depleted nursery into a bedroom on the third floor. It had seemed a momentous thing, a step into the adult world to come. She couldn't have been aware, then, that her steps would be stopped at the threshold of this room, that she and her mother would be yoked together for all eternity, each an irritant to the other. Her mother's silent grief reproached her. Her mother had worn black for her father, but it had been for form's sake. This was something different, something that cut to the bone. There were two things Janie knew her mother to truly love, the family's good name and Bay, both gone in a night. Maybe, for all that he had been the one to speak it, maybe Mr. Burke was right. Maybe there was consolation in truth. Janie sat down on the slipper chair by the window, staring sightlessly at the cretonne shade. Outside, the crowd still clamored. Nothing would bring her brother back, but couldn't she rescue the memory of him? Janie pressed two fingers against the bridge of her nose. Fine words, but she might as well cry for the moon. This wasn't a story by Mr. Arthur Conan Doyle. There was no keen-eyed detective to put together a tiny shred of fabric here and a particular blend of tobacco there, and like that produce a villain from the air. George. The name of the assailant? Or merely her own imagination, grafting meaning onto meaningless sounds? Even if she were willing to go against her mother's expressed wishes, she hadn't the first idea of how to hire a Pinkerton agent. A call on the family lawyer, the nearest male figure of authority, would only generate a corresponding call to her mother, who would make concerned noises about sick headaches and order Gregson to prepare another tisane. It was galling to consider that James Burke had better access to news about her brother's death than she. It was even more galling to think how selectively such information might be used. For all his fine words about truth, the business of a paper was selling papers. The most sensational stories were the ones most likely to be printed. The minions of the world had been over every inch of that ground, ignoring notices to keep out. It was common knowledge that the press had far better resources than the police when it came to the investigation of a crime. The New York Journal's infamous murder squad was one of the sights of the city, a phalanx of reporters on bicycles, wheeling through the city like a flock of crows following the scent of carrion. Macabre, yes, but effective. She didn't know how to hire a detective, but she did know where to find Mr. Burke. The world-building,
with its bold golden dome, loomed over Park Row. She had passed it hundreds of times on her way to the girls' club on Frankfort Street, where she performed those charitable offices that her mother tolerated so audibly. Her mother had never stinted her allowance. She had more than enough money to... Her mind winced away from the word bribe. To persuade Mr. Burke that it might be more noble to share his information before publishing it. It was a mad idea. And yet... Her door opened. Gregson set the tisane on a tray on Janie's nightstand.
"Madam says you're to drink this."
The cup smelled of herbs, and beneath it the familiar sleepy scent of laudanum.
"Thank you,"
said Janie, but she didn't drink. Now was not the time to court oblivion. As the door closed behind Gregson, Janie lifted her hands to her cheeks. Her mother was right. Her face was flushed, but not with fever. London, 1894. February.
"Are you all right?"
Georgie didn't see any obvious signs of abuse, no purple bruises beneath the grease paint, no fingerprints on Kitty's wrists. But something was wrong. Kitty had been distracted all evening, missing her cues and blundering over her lines.
"Why shouldn't I be?"
Kitty yanked on her gloves, knocking over a vial of scent in the process. The lid shattered against the floor, releasing a strong odor of violets.
"Now look what you've made me do!"
Georgie knelt to help gather the shards, the tight breeches she wore as Viola straining dangerously.
"Sorry, Kit," she said. "It's just after your night with Sir Hugo."
"It wasn't a night."
Kitty's voice was so low Georgie could barely hear her.
"What?"
Kitty tugged at the brim of her bonnet, nearly breaking the ribbon.
"It wasn't a night, all right. It wasn't even an hour. He had me up against the wall like a Covent Garden whore. And then he couldn't even..."
Georgie could feel the wall, hard against her back. The grunting, the thrusting. That voice, that familiar voice, taunting her all the while.
"Don't tell me you didn't want this."
Georgie jerked as she cut her finger on a piece of glass. She stared at her finger, at the red drop of blood.
"Oh, Kitty."
She fumbled for a bit of grease-stained cloth to wrap her finger.
"If you'd only come with me."
"And why would I do that? I thought he'd take me home with him, or at least give me supper. So much for that then, right?"
Kitty gave an ugly bark of a laugh.
"At least he paid me. Shoved the coins into my hand and thanked me for a lovely evening."
The echo of Sir Hugo's mockery made Georgie want to slap the man.
"You're better off without Sir Hugo," she said gruffly,
wishing Kitty might have been spared this. "He has a reputation."
"What do I care for his reputation?"
Kitty's voice was shrill. She turned away, but not before Georgie saw the tears in her eyes, tears of fatigue and desperation.
"What am I going to do when the theatre closes, Georgie? What then? Sell cloth by the yard at Liberty's? Wear a white penny in a tea room?"
They'd played to a nearly empty house again. The show couldn't last much longer. Georgie had spotted Mr. Dunstan in the back of the theatre, engaged in conversation with two men who seemed like they'd be more at home in St. Giles than Leicester Square. None of them had looked happy with the conversation. Rising awkwardly from the floor, Georgie dropped the broken pieces of cheap glass onto the dressing table.
"Pouring tea might be preferable to selling yourself on street corners to the likes of Sir Hugo."
"Oh, la-dee-da!"
Kitty marched to the door, her voice hoarse with unshed tears.
"Maybe if you'd left it alone, it wouldn't have been a street corner. All you had to do was stay for supper. But you couldn't even make yourself do that, could you? Too busy making up to that rich American." "Kitty, I wasn't making up."
But Kitty had already given vent to her feelings by slamming the door behind her. Georgie took a deep breath, irritation warring with guilt. She might have stayed with Kitty, but Kitty hadn't wanted her to stay. What was she meant to do, sit there while Sir Hugo fondled them both over the oysters and champagne? Georgie hesitated a moment, and then flung the door open.
Kitty! Kitty, don't be like... Oh!
Hands caught her shoulders hard. She was pressed against a chest redolent of bay rum cologne. The scent rose around her, choking her. Blindly, Georgie pushed back, just trying to get away, away, before the touch of hands on her arms lifted, and she heard a voice saying with concern, "Miss Evans? Miss Evans?" Georgie took an unsteady step back, holding out a hand to set distance between them. She drew in a deep breath, and then another.
"Mr. Van Dyvel!"
Mr. Van Dyvel looked down at her concern.
"I came here to beg your pardon, and now it seems I need to beg your pardon again. May I help?"
"No, it's all right,"
said Georgie shortly, evading the arm he offered her.
"Did you want something?"
"Only to apologize for last night,"
Mr. Van Dyvel said hastily.
"But I didn't mean to intrude on... that is..."
His eyes flicked to her legs in their tight breeches, and then away again. Something about his obvious confusion made Georgie's own cheeks warm, as though she weren't accustomed to showing those same legs to many other men every night. But that was from the safe distance of a stage. Georgie crossed her arms over her chest.
"It's no matter. Didn't your friend tell you there's little modesty in the theatre?"
But she retreated behind the dressing screen all the same.
"My friend," said Mr. Van Dyvel's voice from the other side of the screen, "told me a great many things. I am beginning to believe they were of little value."
Stepping hastily into her dress, Georgie peeked between the panels of the screen. Mr. Van Dyvel was standing on the edge of the room, holding his high-crowned hat between his hands.
"You can sit down if you like."
Thank you."
Tentatively, Mr. Van Dyvel seated himself on the one chair in front of the dressing table, looking curiously at the pots and jars, the grease-stained cloths. He snuck a glance at the screen.
"I didn't mean to intrude. I only wanted to make my apologies for last night."
He'd made his apologies for last night last night. Georgie wiggled out of her breeches beneath the added cover of her skirt.
"You've nothing to be sorry for."
"Haven't I?"
Mr. Van Dyvel turned a little on the stool, but he kept his face averted from the screen, doing his best to afford Georgie some measure of privacy. To the wall, he said,
"You must understand. When Hugo suggested dinner, I never thought..."
"No."
Georgie rather thought he hadn't, but she wasn't going to let him off that easily.
"No."
Earnestly, Mr. Van Dyvel said, as though it made all the difference,
"He has a fiancée in Buckinghamshire."
Did Mr. Van Dyvel really think a man's vows precluded him from taking his pleasure where he found it? Perhaps it was different in New York. Or perhaps it was just Mr. Van Dyvel who was different. Georgie poked her head up over the edge of the screen.
"How did someone like you get mixed up with Sir Hugo? If you don't mind my asking, you seem an odd pair."
Mr. Van Dyvel looked down at the hat balanced on his knees. His hair was the color of August wheat, a dark blonde with lighter streaks speaking of a recent sojourn in sunnier climes.
"I'd been traveling with friends of the family, but when I met Hugo, he persuaded me to leave my party. They're all in Switzerland now."
Georgie emerged from around the side of the screen, dressed now in a reasonable imitation of what a lady might wear, buttoned high to the chin, long and narrow through the sleeves. Mr. Van Dyvel sprang up from his seat, moving aside so that Georgie might reclaim it. It might be as Mr. Van Dyvel said. There were plenty of impoverished nobles eager to batten off the wealthy and naive. Americans, in their perpetual innocence, made a particularly tempting target. Georgie reclaimed her gloves from the dressing table, directing her attention to drawing them on finger by finger.
"Whatever persuaded you to go with him?"
Mr. Van Dyvel turned his hat around in his hands, his expression rueful.
"Hugo can be very charming when he likes, I'd never met anyone quite like him. When he invited me to return with him to London...
Despite herself, Georgie felt herself softening towards him.
Will you join your friends in Switzerland?
Mr. Van Dyvel grimaced. Not now. It's always rather galling to have to admit one's own foolishness. I suppose I ought to have stayed with them. But I'd thought there must be something more to Europe than trotting around with a Baedeker and making a fuss over the locals not speaking a civilized language.
Georgie grinned at his depiction of his party.
It seems you got your wish. I imagine that Sir Hugo knows more than Baedeker about certain corners of the world, and that he was willing to share it for a fee?
Something like that.
Mr. Van Dyvel didn't share her amusement.
I'd never imagined myself worldly, but I hadn't thought myself quite so gullible.
The words hit Georgie harder than she liked to show. She could remember that first month in London, pawning first one, then another piece of jewelry, not sure who to trust, not trusting her own instincts. The one thing she'd learned those first few weeks was how little she knew, how ill-prepared she was to face the world beyond Lincolnshire. But there'd been no choice in it for her.
"What will you do now?" Georgie asked. "Go back to New York?"
"I ought, I suppose," Mr. Van Dyvel said without enthusiasm. "Hugo was the only person I knew in London." He'd got off lightly, Georgie knew. Sir Hugo might have fleeced him in a million ways. Gaming houses had arrangements with the likes of Sir Hugo to bring in likely flats, drawing them deeper and deeper into debt. There were also houses promising all sorts of pleasures. While the pleasure might endure for an evening, the resulting blackmail could go on for years after. Some hardy souls declared publish and be damned, but far more stumped up the blunt demanded for silence. But she couldn't help feeling just a little sorry for Mr. Van Dyvel all the same. It might be a gull, but if it was, Mr. Van Dyvel was a far better actor than anyone she had ever known, either on the stage or off. Slowly, wondering if she was making a mistake, Georgie said,
"We never did have that supper last night."
They could go to the Feathers, where the landlord knew her. She'd be safe there so long as they stayed in plain view, and it wasn't as though Kitty were likely to join her tonight. They'd both lost a friend from this. Making up her mind, Georgie jammed her hat on her head and gestured imperiously to Mr. Van Dyvel.
"What you need is a warm meal in you. A good meat pie does wonders for melancholy."
Chapter 4. London, 1894. February.
"I don't think I've been warm since I left Italy."
Mr. Van Dyvel hunched down into the collar of his coat, rubbing his hands together for warmth. The coveted table by the fire had already been taken when they arrived at the Feathers, leaving only this spot by the crack in the window that never quite seemed to be mended.
"Here," said Georgie, pushing a cup across the table. "This will chase the chill away."
Mr. Van Dyvel accepted it cautiously.
"What is it?"
"Not Blue Ruin,"
said Georgie dryly, and Mr. Van Dyvel had the grace to look abashed.
"Warm port and lemon. Works a treat on wet days. It would take a fair bit of it to put you under the table."
She'd been scandalized once at the idea of drinking in a public house, but her standards had changed along with her speech over the past 3 years. There wasn't any more harm to port and lemon than a genteel glass of sherry, and it did more than cold to keep the cold at bay. Mr. Van Dyvel took a tentative sip.
"It's not bad."
Georgie snorted with laughter.
"You get used to it."
One got used to a lot of things. She curled her fingers around her own glass, feeling the warmth seep into her skin.
"What were you doing in Italy? Sketching statues?"
Mr. Van Dyvel choked on his port.
"Hardly. I can't draw a straight line, much less a landscape."
"Tarbert."
Georgie nodded her thanks as the landlord slapped two pieces of steak and kidney pie down between them.
Why Italy, then?
A grand tour, I suppose you would call it. My last year of law school. I'd been buried in my books for so long. I wanted something different before going into practice.
She'd forgot that he worked for a living.
Georgie took another swig of her port and lemon.
Are you certain you're a solicitor? You're not at all my image of one.
Mr. Van Dyvel's eyes met hers quizzically. You aren't my image of an actress.
Several stage managers felt the same way,
said Georgie dryly. She declaimed prettily enough for drawing-room entertainment, but not for Drury Lane. She had found work initially as a dresser at the Alhambra, and moved from there to a chorus role at the Olympic. Whether or not that was moving up, she couldn't say. The pay was better, but the clothing was scantier. Mr. Van Dyvel wasn't deterred.
It's your voice. It doesn't sound like your friend's.
I'm a good mimic.
But apparently not mimic enough. She'd thought she'd mastered the dialect of her new world. When Mr. Van Dyvel continued to look at her, Georgie elaborated.
I grew up as a companion to a young lady.
The details seemed to whet his interest rather than discourage it.
Were you relations?
Georgie bit her lip.
You might say that.
Might?
Mr. Van Dyvel looked at her searchingly, as though she were a riddle he could solve.
Usually one is a relation or one isn't.
Georgie stared down into her port and lemon. Best to give him the sanitized answer, the tidy one she trotted out for company.
My father was a soldier in the Colonel's regiment. They'd served together in India.
She could picture the Colonel, sun-browned and bluff.
I was raised with the Colonel's daughter, Annabel. Annabel Lacey.
It had been so long since she had said the name that it felt heavy and strange on her tongue. Was it strange that this far away that name still had the power to hurt her? Gently, Mr. Van Dyvel said.
What happened to her?
Why should you think anything happened to her? Your pie will get cold if you don't eat it.
I didn't mean to pry.
Mr. Van Dyvel set his fork down next to his uneaten pie. His eyes lingered on her face.
It was just something in the way you spoke of her, of Annabel Lacey.
Hearing that name made Georgie's throat burn. Her dress felt too tight across the shoulders. Everything felt wrong and strange. The sympathy in Mr. Van Dyvel's voice cut deeper than any insult.
She's gone,
Georgie blurted out. To say it made it feel like it was happening all over. The pain of it. There were times when Georgie missed Annabel so, and others when she wanted to close her eyes and imagine Annabel out of existence, to pretend she never was, had never been, because if she hadn't been, then none of it would ever have happened.
Annabel's gone, and I ran off to tread the boards, as you see.
Georgie picked up her port and lemon, raising it in a mock toast. Mr. Van Dyvel lifted his glass, but didn't drink.
Were you close?
At times.
Memories, like the flash of a kingfisher's wing. Annabel's reflection in the water of the river, laughing. And then later, a slipper by the river's edge, a hair ribbon caught on a floating branch.
At times. You know how it is when you grow up with someone.
To her surprise, Mr. Van Dyvel nodded.
My cousin Anne. She's more of a sister to me than my own sister, for better and worse. There are times...
He paused, choosing his words carefully.
There are times when we feel like two parts of the same person, if that isn't too fanciful.
No.
Georgie's voice was hoarse. From the port, of course. It took her that way sometimes.
No, not fanciful at all.
It was surprisingly seductive to be allowed to speak of Annabel. How had their conversation become so intimate?
She had shared more with Mr. Van Dyvel in an hour than she had told Kitty in a year. It must be because he was a stranger, an American. She could use him as a Catholic would a confessor, murmuring,